select a new late-night TV station, a rough ride for UK radio, a far cry from the long-promised boom, and Weir FM in Sunderland. The community radio station has been on air a year. How are things going for them? High-temperature superconductivity in space, the latest on cinema digital sound. How will the Independent Television Commission ease the birth of Channel 5 television? Radio mics in the theatre, problems with BBC Radio Derby's aerial, as much more as we can fit in, and of course your letters. It's Sparks on Radio Fax 3910 6205 and 12255.
She packed my bag last night, pre-flight. 0 hour. 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much, I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space on such a time.
Thank you. Here's a piece in Lineup magazine about radio microphones for theatre stage shows. Let's start with a piece about a company called Autograph, providing the sound for Starlight Express. Computer-controlled routing is used to switch 22 microphone channels, 20 of them radio mics, to different VCA groups for lead vocals, chorus vocals, or mute, as required for each number. When the show opened in March 1984, there were only 4 radio mic channels allocated for theatre use, so most of the mics were illegally operating on frequencies used by broadcasters. This was quite common at the time. If a broadcast crew needed to use radio mics at a theatre, they would agree channels with the stage sound crew. The infamous Starlight Express incident, when a powerful link transmitter in a BBC outside broadcast van preparing for Vox Pop interviews outside the theatre on opening night wiped out the radio mics inside the theatre, gained a lot of publicity and brought matters to a head. The theatre lobby, headed by Autograph, pointed out that the new shows, especially imports from the United States, and those written by Andrew Lloyd Webber, had far greater emphasis on sound. Some were totally amplified, and lack of extra frequencies could shut down theatre in the West End and kill the tourist trade. The Department of Trade and Industry was persuaded that the theatre had a genuine need for more frequencies, and was already considering new frequency allocations for broadcast radio mics in VHF and UHF at the time. So the new allocations were extended to include 26 channels for theatre use, 6 in VHF band 3, 4 each in UHF television channels 22, 24 and 25, and 8 in channel 35. Channel 5 television may occupy UHF channel 35 at some future date, and the theatre will require a new allocation. Autograph was very pleased to go legal. Sound operators can complain officially about interference on their channels, although kitting out with the new UHF equipment was a very expensive operation. The company now has over 500 radio mic transmitters, mainly Micron CNS units, and some Sennheisers spread across some 16 West End shows. Up to 150 can be in use on any one night. These manage to survive the rigors of backstage life, despite the microdot connectors used by Sennheiser, which are much less robust than the LiMo connectors used on Micron units, but are a quarter the size. In fact, Sennheiser designed their own more rugged version of the microdot connector about a year ago. Matt McKenzie, one of Autograph's sound designers, reports that the same UHF channels are used in adjacent theatres without any problem, unless a transmitter fails in one show and the receiver picks up that channel from the show next door. UHF does require more care to get good reception, particularly as the original specification allowed only 10 milliwatts from body-worn transmitters, which lost a lot of signal into sweaty performers. This has been eased by the change to 50 milliwatts for body-worn units. Aerials are positioned as near to the transmitters as possible. Sennheiser ground plane antennas have been used below a wooden stage to good effect. Sometimes a Yagi is aimed at the stage to discriminate against a nearby source of interference, or less sensitive dipoles may be hidden in the set to improve the ratio of signal to interference. Receivers are usually in the wings, where a radio mic operator can keep an eye on things. The Micron system of early warning of transmitter battery failure is useful here, but there is often a handheld radio mic available as a standby. Audio engineering provide a mimic display showing receiver status, which is mounted on the mixing desk in the stalls for the sound operator. The Sennheiser system provides for a remote display on a computer screen. Battery life depends on how hard the transmitters have to work. Some shows might use new batteries every night, while others manage 3 shows before they need replacing. Autograph have the used batteries returned to base in bulk, so they can be safely disposed of without releasing unfriendly mercury into the environment. This is a legal requirement in some European countries, but battery manufacturers in Britain leave it to private enterprise. Microphones used are usually the tiny Sennheiser MKE2 Electrets in black or flesh colour, worn on the forehead in a wig or headgear, a technique developed for Starlight Express by Martin Levin and Andrew Bruce. It gets a nice clean sound at a level the transmitter can handle, avoiding chest resonances, but gets the mics soaked in sweat every night. They become throwaway items after about 6 months. Producers have come to accept the trade-off between sound quality and expense, Matt McKenzie observes. In one show, a particular performer's mic would fail at the same point each night. This was traced to the ingress of sweat during a very energetic number. Michael Crawford's role in Billy, which was mixed by Julian Beach for Theatre Projects, was a case in point, and necessitated two transmitters, one close to his skin and a spare hidden in his jacket. The transmitters, which turned green with corrosion, had to be wrapped in plastic, sealed with gaffer tape, and checked at the interval when the batteries were replaced. Apart from the technicalities of radio microphones, sound designers also have to consider the psychological impact on artists. Will they or won't they cooperate? And where to position the transmitter. Often the only suitable place, depending on costume restriction, is hidden beneath underclothes. Great tact and sensitivity, and warm hands, are required during the backstage transmitter changeovers. It is not uncommon to see a line of raised skirts in the wings, whilst performers chat amiably with one another, awaiting their transmitter refits. Interesting situations sometimes develop offstage as performers forget they are wired for sound, whilst they swap gossip, visit the toilet, and otherwise occupy themselves between cues. Sony ECM77 electrets are also used and seem to resist the sweat better, but they are more expensive. Autograph has recently tried out the even more expensive and minute Sanken COS11. Tango Argentina at the Aldwych uses the Sennheiser SKM4031 handheld radio mics set to minimum sensitivity to withstand powerful operatic-style singers. After Starlight Express, Clive Green and Autograph developed a series of mixers for live theatre shows, which is now in its third generation as the E-Type, which has computer control to assign channels to VCA groups and to store snapshots of VCA levels for each number. The computer also has an event trigger for effects cues and a MIDI output which can reset outboard equalizers, delays and reverbs. Broadcast cart machines are usually used for pre-recorded cues such as sound effects. Last year, Matt McKenzie worked on Ben Elton's Gasping, which involved a hectic mimed squash game using the auditorium as the court. Effects of racket striking ball and ball striking rear wall of theatre had to be timed precisely to the action. Carts were not fast enough, so the effects were stored on a sampler, which also has the advantage that stored sounds can be reproduced in any order. Autograph takes sound effects creation very seriously and has its own neat, well-organized small studio at its Kentish town base, equipped with cart machines, DAT machines, Studer mixer, outboard effects units, and, as a measure of its commitment to quality, an 8-track DAR soundstation too. This offers recording, non-destructive editing, looping, and time compression and expansion all within the digital domain, and at a great deal faster rate than the previous tape and blade method of editing tape. Some productions employ a freelance sound designer. In this case, Autograph provides technical consultancy for the equipment, and recommends suitable sound operators who are employed by the producer and become very much part of the show. Over the years, Autograph has built up its own staff of sound designers, including Andrew Bruce and Julian Beach, who have worked on numerous plays and musicals all over the world. Having watched Autograph operators in action on live shows, it is clear that their work has a lot in common with live broadcasting in terms of adrenaline, seat-of-the-pants operation, and sound quality. That's a piece by Tim Smith in Lineup, the journal of the Institute of Broadcast Sound.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. It's our weekly programme of media, scientific and technical news. Well, writing from Letchworth in Hertfordshire is Mike Barraclough, who says, "Keep up the good work with Radio Facts and especially Sparks, which I usually tune into. I like the item about Channel 5, which mirrored a conversation I had with a group of DXers recently." Well, there's another item about Channel 5 this week. Well, Mike mentions DXers because he's associated with the World DX Club, and he sent a copy of their latest magazine, which is 50 pages long. Incredible value and incredible weight to send through the post. And if you'd like to join the World DX Club, rather, the UK secretary is Arthur Ward, 17 Motspur Drive, Northampton, England, NN26LY. Arthur Ward, 17 Motspur Drive, Northampton, England, NN26LY. A brief look through the Contact magazine. There's shortwave news from radio stations all over the world. There's also medium-wave DX news and VHF and a bit of satellite news. Particularly useful bit, I think, is around the clock. There's a listing of broadcasts in English. So you can look at a particular time of day and a particular day of the week, and it will tell you where to tune to hear some English. There's also clandestine news and a rather fun bit at the very front, Old Radio Hype, an American advertisement from 1925. Christmas and the whole world is young again. The air is a quiver, the ether crowded with Yuletide music. The carols, the simple songs that carry us back to a rose-tinted childhood are beating their soundless tattoos at our hearthstones. Radio is the magic key which transforms it all into glorious sounds. For your utmost is radio enchantment. You will equip your set with tubes. A Valve advertisement from 1925. And from 1923, from Marconi, many of the older people regret scattering of the younger folk to their various occupations and amusements, and think sadly of the old-fashioned family evening, but broadcasting has brought this back again. Completely at ease in an atmosphere of charming contentment, shimmering silk, well-groomed masculinity, soft lights and a background of sweet music, subdued lights and warmer chords subtly blending with the insinuating melody of fine radio, Burgoyne radio. That's Radio Pictorial, 1936. The ultimate of luxury is listening to opera in bed in the dark when one has retired early and dined off a boiled egg in a tray. Rebecca West, writing in 1929. Oh, you radio! Oh, what I owe to you, my radio! I listen in and you dispel the gloom, for you bring all the stars into my room. Oh, you radio, you're the most entertaining friend I know. You give me music, dancing, joys I never knew. Radio, I'm radiating thanks to you. That's the theme song from Radio Olympia, 1936. And the Prince of Wales' latest motor car radio outfit is absolutely reliable, cannot run down, and has no batteries. It is connected directly to the big battery built into the car. 1934 Radio Times. And finally, a newspaper advertisement in 1924. Wireless set for sale. Or would exchange for intelligent parrot. A marvellous magazine there, Contact, from the World DX Club. Gossip, news, reviews, and 50 pages long. Great value for members.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. Till I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The High Temperature Superconductivity Space Experiment in Microwave Journal by Dennis Webb and M. Nizanov. The designers of satellite systems demand high system performance with minimum weight, volume, and electrical input power. For more than 20 years, spacecraft designers have realized that for many applications, superconductivity offers the best performance with a minimal of electrical power. However, all superconducting materials known before 1986 could only be operated slightly above 4 Kelvin, the boiling point of helium. This requires a very sophisticated, heavy and bulky cryogenic enclosure for a typical spacecraft mission of 5 to 10 years. With the exception of a few demanding scientific missions, such as the Infrared Astronomical Observatory, IRAS, space designers have had little interest in operating at liquid helium temperatures, and hence very little interest in superconductivity. The introduction of superconductivity above the boiling point of liquid nitrogen, 77 degrees Kelvin, has greatly reduced the refrigeration burden associated with the use of superconductivity in space systems. Under certain spacecraft conditions, temperatures in the range of 70 to 100 Kelvin can be obtained using only passive radiative cooling techniques. Realizing the implications this breakthrough in superconductivity might have upon future spacecraft missions, the United States Naval Research Laboratory initiated a program in 1988 known as the High Temperature Superconductivity Space Experiment, a highly focused and coordinated program with the goal of demonstrating the feasibility of incorporating this technology into space systems. The surface resistance of the high-temperature superconductivity materials is typically one or two orders of magnitude lower than that of copper at the same temperature and frequency, enabling great performance improvements to be achieved over conventional devices. Coupled line microstrip filters with bandwidths in the range of 500 to 700 MHz at 10 GHz and less than 1 dB of insertion loss at 77 Kelvin, that's 2 to 3 dB lower than cooled copper counterparts. Also, microstrip resonators with Qs of 10,000 at 5 GHz. The Qs of these resonators are 30 times higher than normal metal resonators at the same temperature, since conductivity loss is the dominant loss mechanism in microstrip resonators. Utilization of space data is an important part of the high-temperature superconductivity program. The space data will be used to supply information on the degradation of HTS devices in the Earth's radiation belt and on their reliability while operating in the space environment. The space data will be supplied to the HTSSE contractors to enable them to evaluate the devices and develop more radiation-resistant reliable devices. Part of a report in Microwave Journal.
Here's a story about medium wave transmitting aerial problems. It's all about the local radio service for Derby and the BBC site at Burniston, where there were problems with the antenna which kept causing the transmitter to trip out and take the service off the air. This is published in Transmission Technical Letters, the technical newsletter from BBC Transmission. The site of the local radio Derby MF transmitter was moved 2 years ago to allow the construction of the Toyota car assembly plant in Derbyshire. The new station was equipped with a 1 kilowatt solid-state Eddystone transmitter and a T antenna, which is supported by 3 20-meter wooden poles spaced 40 meters apart across a field at Burniston. This type of low-cost MF antenna has been installed at 4 other sites for local radio transmissions. In December, when the great snows struck the Midlands, Burniston tripped off and resisted attempts to reset it, even when the antenna had been cleared of snow. It had to be rematched, indicating a permanent change of electrical characteristics, and Transmission Technical Investigations was asked to respond with an investigation. Our first thoughts were that the weather must be causing the ground conditions to vary, or that the earth mat may have an intermittent break. Before we could establish this further, a shutdown occurred when the matching coil tap became loose, tripping the transmitter. This was attributed to poor design of the coil tap and considered to be an isolated event. A data logging system was installed, and the antenna VSWR at carrier frequency measured and recorded every minute. Analysis of the early recordings showed 2 distinct patterns of variation. One was a gradual increase to about 16% reflection over 2 to 3 hours, returning to the normal 3 to 4% in a matter of minutes. The other showed irregular high VSWR variations reaching 40% and changing every few minutes for up to half an hour before returning to normal. The effect of wind seemed a possible cause of the latter, and the fitting of a stabilizer halfway up the center pole appeared to reduce the rapid variations, but did not eliminate them entirely. More trips occurred, and it was agreed that local radio Derby could reset the transmitter themselves, as they are considerably nearer than the engineering team. Apart from the incident of the coil tap failure, no evidence of a fault condition appeared, and the transmitter could be reset immediately after a trip. A further transmitter trip was reset by the engineer in charge, Radio Derby, and on this occasion he was to discover a possible cause of the problem. He had reset the transmitter and then observed a higher reflected power indication than normal. Looking outside, he saw a flock of starlings perched on the antenna wires and watched the reflection decrease as his colleague scared them away. At last, we knew what the problem was, or so we thought. A plan of attack against the starlings was evolved, making use of a programmable logic controller, PLC, to provide auto-reset facilities. The transmitter trip level was relaxed to about 55% reflected power, with automatic power reduction commencing at about 18%. The PLC was also programmed to reset the transmitter to normal power operation when the reflection reduced below 10%, built-in hysteresis, in addition to a 3-shot reset facility. It was also programmed to trigger an explosive bird scarer and a camera focused on the antenna to provide evidence of the bird strikes. The bird scarer is a standard agricultural device which ignites a liquid petroleum gas mixture within a barrel and acoustically scares the birds. The coil and tap were also changed for one of better design. Data logging was continued, and we waited for results. A few weeks later, Sutton Coalfield reported trips and power reductions. Therefore, a visit was made to retrieve the film. A complete set of pictures of rain, and not a bird in sight. The trips were attributed to a lightning storm, and tests showed the gas gaps protecting the feeder system to be defective. Thus, the two types of variation shown in the recordings are attributed to weather effects and perching birds. The weather effects appear to be more significant, and it was necessary to establish whether the problem was due to changes in ground or earth mat conditions, or an effect directly on the antenna. Derby Fire Service was contacted, and it was arranged for a fire appliance and crew to assist in site tests. The fire brigade turned up, fully crewed, and with the capability of spraying 500 gallons of water within a couple of minutes, a local hydrant being available to replenish the appliance for further tests. Initially, the ground was soaked, and then the outer poles, causing a variation of a few percent. When the centre pole was sprayed from the ground upwards, the reflection increased quickly to about 20% at half height and reached 40% when sprayed to its full height. The reflection then slowly reduced to 3 or 4% in 25 to 30 minutes. The wooden pole, which is creosoted, does not absorb undue quantities of water. So, a redesign of the supporting system is in hand. That piece was by Adrian Hartley from BBC Transmitter Technical Investigations, all about the problems they have trying to keep BBC MF services on the air.
Please. Philips DC 777 shortwave car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC 777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM, FM tuner and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size in-car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 2190 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is auto reverse and high quality. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it also received 4 stars in the Radio Netherland receiver shopping list. This top of the range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Call the sales line at Radiofax on 0483 275 997 or write for more information to Radiofax The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG.
You're listening to Sparks, this week presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. A letter from Siegfried Huffig in Bremerhaven in Germany. He listens on 3910 on a Sony ICF-2001D with a telescopic antenna. I listened to your station for the first time. The programme was interesting for me. And also thanks to Dr. Luke van der Stock in Belgium, listening also on 3910. I have today been listening. A very interesting technical programme. I was very surprised by the Sparks programme. Well, thanks very much, Dr. Luke.
The BBC plans a select television service with adverts, with channels aimed at minority groups using the corporation's spare airtime, by Alexander Garrett in The Independent on Sunday. The inhabitants of Glenroe are scandalised. Dinny and Teasy have come back from holiday to reveal they have been secretly married. Will Millie lose the cottage? Could this be the end of the Byrne dynasty? This time next year, Irish exiles in Britain should no longer have to wait for such cliffhangers to be resolved in the post from home. Glenroe, the Republic's top-rating TV soap, is part of a 3-hour weekly package being planned by Ireland's state broadcaster RTE under the BBC's embryonic television subscription service BBC Select. Over the next 2 years, the BBC plans to launch a couple of dozen such channels, catering for groups as diverse as Asians, accountants, farmers and foreign movie buffs. The initiative comes from the BBC's money-making arm, BBC Enterprises, and it means that, for the first time in the corporation's history, it will have its name on a broadcasting service that carries advertising. But the venture has had an inauspicious start. First, there was the failure of British Medical Television, a prototype channel for doctors that closed last year, leaving the BBC £500,000 out of pocket. That was blamed on faulty technology. Then, a year ago, the full-scale launch of subscription television, now dubbed BBC Select, was postponed until this year. This time, the culprit was the recession. John Radcliffe, the man who launched the BBC microcomputer and is now managing director of BBC Select, explains, "We looked at the high street and the economic situation and decided it would be more sensible to wait until 1992 when people are ready to start spending again." He acknowledges that this time the BBC has got to get it right. The concept behind BBC Select is to make use of the 6 or 7 hours of unused airtime on BBC One and BBC Two each night. During one of her more vehement Beeb-bashing forays, Margaret Thatcher reportedly threatened to offer a franchise for the night hours to outsiders if the BBC would not use them. The BBC's plan is to act as a host to programmes that cater for minority groups. In case that sounds a familiar recipe, Mr. Matt Radcliffe says, "Our groups will be a lot smaller than Channel 4's. In industry jargon, it is called narrowcasting." As well as paying a monthly fee, subscribers will need a decoder, which chooses the programmes they are entitled to, unscrambles the signal, and downloads it to a video recorder. Half the programmes will be for viewers at home, while the remainder will be aimed at professional groups. First on air in May will be the Executive Business Club, a Manchester-based enterprise which promises to serve up an hour a week of advice on such sober topics as managing people, forecasting sales, and marketing sense. Chief Executive Graham Robinson says they will appeal to people who do not have the time to disappear for a week-long training course, and he has set a target of having 400 companies subscribing by the launch date. In July, a service for Asian viewers will follow, incorporating chunks of news and entertainment from the Indian subcontinent. The aim is to roll out another half dozen services by the end of September and have as many as 25 by 1994. Mr. Radcliffe estimates that the services aimed at professionals may be able to break even with as few as 1,000 subscribers, while those targeted at consumers will probably need an audience of at least 25,000. By 1996, when the BBC's charter comes up for renewal, it is expected that BBC Select will have a total advertising audience of 500,000. Small beer compared to the 17 million who tune into Coronation Street, perhaps, but useful ammunition for those who want to see advertising on BBC One and BBC Two. That was by Alexander Garrett in The Independent on Sunday.
A letter from Helmut Reitzer Jr., who's 25 years old, and writes from Schwaltemel, I think, in Germany. I found your programme very good. He listens on an Eddystone 7301A with a long wire aerial. The signal in West Germany was very strong. He sent his own QSL card, thanks. And a couple of postcards from another German, Michael Linder, who's in Triptis. I listened for the first time. Pardon for my bad English. I have not learned the English language in the school. My little English is my hobby. Well, excellent English is it is too, really. He reports he's listening on 6205. He also sends a picture of his restaurant, set in the middle of some football pitches by the look of it. Oh no, there's a banqueting suite and all sorts of function rooms. So that's Michael Linder in Triptis in Germany.
I bet they're living.
This week on Sparks, BBC Select, a new late-night TV station, Rough Ride for UK Radio, a far cry from the long-promised boom, and Weir FM in Sunderland, community radio station has been on air a year. How are things going up there with them? High-temperature superconductivity in space, the latest on cinema digital sound, Channel 5, how will the Independent Television Commission ease its birth? Radio mics in the theatre and BBC problems with local radio in Derbyshire's Aerial. So, as the BBC cuts costs, licences languish unwanted and newcomers struggle, Martin Rowe sees little prospect of the long-promised radio boom in The Independent. A rough ride on the airwaves. Hardly into the new year, it already looks a dire one for the radio industry. Recently, the Radio Authority reached the end of its tether with the directors of the London-wide Spectrum Radio, the country's only multi-ethnic station, giving it just days to solve its financial problems. A new investor, Harmony Investments, has now promised to inject money into the station, which has debts of £450,000, keeping at bay the Radio Authority's threat of taking away its licence. In the same week, BBC Radio's latest cost-cutting led to 40 studio managers being laid off, half of them at Radio 1. In Kent, Invicta Radio recently merged with Southern Radio, laid off 6 broadcasters. In less than a month, applications have to be received at the Radio Authority for INR2, the second national commercial station to be offered. The first, Classic FM, opens later this year. So far, only 2 groups have even hinted at interest, despite the fact that a national commercial pop station has been long tipped as a gold mine. This year has started as the old one finished, with the long-promised boom in British radio looking as distant a prospect as ever. Although many new licences were advertised and awarded by the Radio Authority in 1991, only Shetland Islands Broadcasting actually started legal transmissions, and it was on the air already illegally. The next new station will serve Pitlochry and Aberfeddy in Tayside, but only on weekends and serving just 5,000 people. The optimism and prophecies of Boom, the industry's own soundtrack to the first wave of new stations in 1989, are no more. The experience of the first stage in radio's expansion has brought realism. The new incremental stations, authorised before the Broadcasting Act and set up to expand existing commercial choice, have had a rough ride. All of them, without exception, have found it very tough going, says Brian West, Managing Director of the Association of Independent Radio Companies. They came on air just as the recession was starting to bite. Many have been bought up or heavily propped up by other independent local radio companies. KFM in Stockport, for example, has been taken over by Signal Radio in Stoke. Buzz FM in Birmingham is now controlled by Radio Clyde, while FTP for the People, a black station in Bristol, has become Galaxy Radio, controlled by Radio Chiltern. Centre Sound in Stirling, taken over by Radio Stirling, has become Centre FM, after prolonged uncertainty. All is not doom and gloom, however. The latest figures from JICRA, the industry's research bureau covering the last quarter of 1991, give independent radio a record audience share of 37.9%. Some stations are beginning to flourish, after difficult starts, despite the paucity of advertising revenue. The contrasting performances are dramatically illustrated by 2 stations based only a few miles apart and uniquely sharing a frequency, each broadcasting for 3 bands of 4 hours every day. At the offices of London Greek Radio, on an industrial estate in Haringey, Managing Director Andreas Populudru can barely contain his euphoria when describing how fortunes turned in 1991. In its first 2 years, LGR lost more than £250,000. But after a management reshuffle last summer, he predicts third-year profits of more than £100,000. The station is turning its clearly identified, passionately loyal audience London's 250,000 Greeks into profits. You can go to their homes and there may be three radios on in different rooms, kitchen, sitting room and bedroom, all tuned into LGR. They don't want to miss a single word. London Greek Radio has a genuine community feel. One old man, for instance, rang in from a phone box because he was lost. The only number he could remember was LGR's. A woman rang because her house was full of snakes. Dr. Polly Drew called the council in. What we offer goes far beyond most other radio stations, he says. People believe LGR is theirs. We're like a combination of church, embassy, school, community centre and advice bureau. Rising advertising revenue is being boosted by a mail order business in Cypriot products. We are only allowed 9 minutes advertising an hour, but we could sell more. Advertisers are desperate to get on, said Dr. Polyduru. It's all very different at WNK, originally Wicked Neutral and Kicking. In Wood Green, whose managing director Joe Douglas talks bitterly of cash crises, an unhelpful radio authority, and a dramatic loss of listeners when the London-wide Kiss FM came on air in the autumn of 1990. Mr. Douglas launched the station as a pirate in 1986 and went legal in November 1989, and was then himself plagued by pirate competitors. But the biggest difficulty has been sharing airtime with the Greeks. A lot of people who support us find it difficult having to switch on and off every 4 hours, he says. After 2 years of heavy losses, staffing levels have been slashed to a 3-strong sales team, 3 in administration and 8 part-time presenters. Mr. Douglas says that the broadcasting bill has been adversely applied in the case of WNK. It promised greater choice, but if this is so, there would have been no Kiss FM, which plays exactly the music we do. How the hell are we expected to survive? The contrasting fates of these two stations offers a warning to the radio industry at the start of an ambitious year of growth. As more competition hits the airwaves, Steve Hyde, broadcast director at the advertising specialist Zenith Media, believes that only those who find their own audiences will survive. The real stars, notably Kiss and Melody in London, are the ones who have found niches with large audiences and generated revenue. Mr. West confirms this. Where you've got a service that reaches a tightly knit community group, who own it as their own station, then success is more likely. Small stations in big metropolitan areas need to be much more clearly defined. He points to the Isle of Wight, where the new station has won an audience from Southampton's popular Ocean Sound, because it is, like the population, proudly island-based. Similarly, Avtar Lit Sunrise FM in Southall and Ealing is targeting by a large niche audience, the Asian community. Ironically, specialist incrementals like Weir FM and London Greek Radio may have less to fear from the arrival of INR 1 and 2 than pop-based ILR stations. Mr. West advises ILR stations to keep their nerve and not go looking for alternative music formats. Their unique selling point is their local relevance, which the nationals will never have. The future is very bright, said Dr. Polyduru. Lots of listeners would rather hear Greek music than Madonna. That previous comment about the unique selling point of ILR being their local relevance may well be true. However, many of the ILRs carry national syndicated services and are split into large regions. So it could be that the only way of them surviving is to break up into smaller groups again, although there are large costs involved with doing that. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts.
Now a look at the only incremental station which has not been swallowed up by ILRs. Weir FM. In Lineup, Kate White travelled up there to find out what life is like for Britain's smallest radio station. Weir FM won its licence in 1989, one of the first batch of 21 incrementals. It was not the most auspicious of times, with the Gulf War looming and a deepening recession. In Sunderland itself, 800 years of shipbuilding tradition was about to be snuffed out. In other ways, the time was ripe. Sunderland, although larger, is overshadowed by its neighbour, Newcastle. The rivalry between the cities and their respective rivers, the Wear and the Tyne, is a time-honoured one. Sunderland's Makehams do not appreciate being mistaken for Newcastle Geordies, nor do they appreciate Newcastle having all the region's media outlets and getting more attention in general. Sunderland was fertile ground for a radio station. In the short time Wear FM has been on air, it has firmly established itself in the community and beyond. A recent survey revealed a sizeable 32% reach, placing it second in terms of listeners to the region's ILR, Metro Radio. The background to this success explains much about the unique circumstances of community radio. Of the 10 incrementals awarded community licenses, only Wear FM remains, the rest having been swallowed up by larger commercial stations. The idea for Wear FM was conceived in 1985 with the founding of the Sunderland Community Radio Association, the SCRA. With the North East in economic decline, the SCRA thought a CR station could offer much to the community: training and education, a local advertising medium, support for local music and activities. Frustrated when the government deferred offering licenses in 1985, SCRA spent 4 years in waiting. During that time, SCRA Secretary Alan Fry established links with Sunderland Polytechnic, while Andrew Crissell, the Communication Studies course leader, was quick to see the benefits of having a radio station on campus. The Polytechnic's support was to be a major factor in the SCRA winning its license in 1989. The search then began for a station manager. By chance, Peter O'Shaughnessy was in London taking a sabbatical from 13 years in community radio in Australia. She had met Alan Fry in 1988 when he visited Australia to study public radio there. O'Shaughnessy spent the first year fundraising, some £200,000 worth of support in all, certain that grants were the best option until the station could build up sufficient advertising revenues. The Polytechnic provided premises and a technician's salary, Metro Radio supplied transmission facilities, and the Wearside Opportunity, a project linking local businesses with government funding, organised money and the services of a financial consultant. Sunderland Council provided cash via urban programme funds. The philosophy was to not put money into glamorous offices, being based at the Poly enabled them to bring local people onto campus and encourage a good educational culture, explained O'Shaughnessy. In the large room in the Polytechnic's Forster building that serves as Wear FM's nerve centre, one is greeted by the cheerful, organised chaos that lays behind many a broadcasting effort. Across the hall is a room housing newsroom and production staff. Down the hall are the studios, one on air and one production, equipped almost identically to allow the two to swap functions. Both were built from modular kits supplied by KFA, assembled by Wear FM chief engineer Paul Graham and a horde of volunteers, with welcome advice from TFM Radio's Steve Bone. The desks come from Australia's PKE, Poolkirk Enterprises, whose consoles are widely used down under by commercial and community broadcasters. They are the first in Britain, but unlikely to be the last. PKE has just set up European distribution via Trilogy Broadcasting in Andover. We had fights over the mixers, but the PKEs are the best in the world for what they do. The presenters like them, says O'Shaughnessy. At the time, no UK company was making a purpose-designed community radio desk. The budget desks available were either not sturdy enough, had complicated controls, or were difficult to service. The PKEs are simple. Pan pots, equalisation, and tone controls are all inside the modules, leaving presenters with just three controls to fidget with: on-off, cue, and fader. Chief Engineer Paul Graham notes, It's important that the desks are easy to use. We don't want to lose talented presenters by technically overloading them. We have a visually handicapped presenter who manages nicely. We just run the chatter clock up on the fader so that he can announce the time. A fair amount of equipment was obtained second-hand. Some came from a radio station in Brixton, while the Philips VCR used for logging were picked up for a mere £600 each. The Polytechnic supplied a computer to handle station logs. Weir FM's spending priorities have undoubtedly paid off. The difficult IBA specification was met and passed on the first try. The sound quality of the station's output is very good, reaching a wider area than one might expect for an 80-watt station. We are pleasantly surprised at the professionalism of the output, said Keith Rain, chief executive of TWO. Although we see the station as a useful support for local business, at the end of the day, it's very much a matter of civic pride. We detect that increasingly Sunderland is proud of its radio station. That Weir FM operates with the same professionalism observable in any successful broadcasting outfit explodes any stereotypical images of community radio. At the same time, the community and training aspect is there, continuing discreetly in the background. Although our raison d'etre is as a broadcast-based training and regeneration project in Wearside, says O'Shaughnessy, we have to be completely professional as broadcasters in programming, advertising, technical. Otherwise, we will not get the audience or the advertising money. As for programming, Weir FM offers some of the most exciting radio this writer has heard in Britain. It's a 24-hour-a-day part format, a bland title that belies the innovative mix of specialist music, talk, sport, and other shows targeted at large minority interests in the area. The weekday breakfast, morning, and drive shows pull the adverts and provide a solid commercial core. Talk shows covering the gamut of interests are interspersed, and local news is generated until 1 p.m. This is provided in cooperation with the Sunderland Echo newspaper, which funded the Weir FM's news training programme, the first of its kind in the country. On weekday evenings, the studio fills up with children for Weir Classy, a chart-based show for kids to do their homework to. Boogie Bass and Soul Fish follows with 4 hours of hardcore dance music, with the Flyby Night Club filling the overnight slot. On Saturdays, morning sport is followed by music, 50s, 60s and 70s, local bands, soul and reggae. The Sunday morning religious broadcast gives way to yet more specialist music, jazz and blues, local bands, folk, country, rock and heavy metal. Within this framework, programmes are very nearly free form. It is a very long way from the usual diet of top 40 oft heard on commercial radio. And the specialist music format has proved very successful. Being specialist gives us national recognition and a good commercial competitive edge. Also, because our playlists are not prepared weeks in advance, we can respond quickly and get something on air. The whole operation is kept running by 5 full-timers, 6 part-timers, and over 100 volunteers. The station has brought the local radio enthusiasts out of the woodwork and encouraged many others to develop an interest. All our volunteers have picked up the broadcast skills with no problem, says O'Shaughnessy. Some say you can't rely on volunteers, but we find that by treating them as professionals, they behave like professionals. Beyond the hard-headed commercial approach, O'Shaughnessy is ever aware of the flip side of Weir FM, its role in the community. Much of the programming itself, as well as being popular, has been of specific benefit to the community. Weir FM is also ceaselessly active in training and education, training local people in media skills, working with the Polytechnic's media program students, taking part in plans for the Polytechnic's proposed distance learning program. The station also does regular roadshows to reach different parts of the community. Everyone who comes into contact with the station is encouraged to take a course, be it for leisure or career building. One area we'd like to expand is for a proper newsroom for training polytechnic students and local people for media degree qualifications, says O'Shaughnessy. We also want production facilities for both recording and training purposes. As for the future, she's optimistic that Weir FM could well become successful enough to pose serious competition to commercial radio stations. Advertising revenue, always a hard slog for a new station, is building nicely. As for the future of community radio generally in Britain, she notes, given the current recession in the UK, it's going to be very difficult for CR to get off the ground. It would help if the copyright agencies were more sensible about stations our size. They are listening to us, but we need action. Nonetheless, O'Shaughnessy has a gleam in her eye as she mentions that Heartland in Scotland have won a community radio licence in the last batch of incremental awards. Once they're on air, Weir FM will neither be the smallest radio station nor the only community radio station in Britain. That was by Kate White in Lineup, which is the journal of the Institute of Broadcast Sound.
Have any 813 valves in your junk box? We've now used up all our own stocks, so if you have any 813s you don't want and you'd like to see them going to a good use, please wrap them up well and send them to us. We will immediately refund your postage costs and put them to good use. Our address is Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. That's Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And any letter you write will be acknowledged on air. And if you'd like a reply in writing, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. Well, a letter from Leonard Brown in Ashton-on-Mersey, Sale in Cheshire. I was listening to my radio on the 20th of January when I picked up your station for the first time. I wish all the staff at Radio Facts the very best. Thanks, Mr. Brown, for the postcards for decorating the studio. Three ones of scenes around Cheshire and Manchester. And, writing from Victoria Park in Manchester, is Nick Smith. Just thought I'd drop you a short line to say hello. I've been listening to your programmes for a few months now, and I think you're great. I tried your recommendation of adding a ground plane to reduce overloading, and it actually works with my ICF-7600. However, I think you should tell your listeners that a correctly matched antenna also makes a big difference, as I recently discovered. Here at university, I have to make do with a fairly short, long wire, which especially at low frequencies presents a varying impedance to the receiver input, not the normal 50 ohm feed. From transmission line theory, a mismatch in impedance cause is a reflection of part of the signal from the receiver input, effectively wasting it. I built a Pi network matching unit using two variable capacitors from old radios and a home-wound tapped inductor, approximately 100 turns on a 2-inch diameter 22 SWG wire, tapped at around 2, 3, 4, 6, 8, 12, 15, 25, 50, 75, and 80 turns. That's 100 turns on a 2-inch diameter pipe of 22 SWG wire. It really does improve the thing greatly, often making unusable signals quite audible. An extra advantage is that off-tune signals are rejected and not coupled to the receiver, so helping to avoid overloading the input stages with strong local stations. The pirate radio scene here in Manchester is as strong as ever, with the FM band overcrowded at weekends. In fact, some of the stations are accusing each other of being greedy of band space on air. But why is 106 to 108 megahertz never used? I've never heard anything there. I think it's just because no one ever gets used to tuning up there, so people don't tend to go up there. Anyway, here is a rundown of currently operating FM stations. Paradise Cheshire 105.5, broadcasting test transmissions over Christmas with a good mix of music, some old classics, quite professional with good audio quality but not stereo. They're around Tameside. A station of unknown origin on 104.4 with a strong carrier but never any modulation. This has been on for ages now, but its purpose or origin is a complete mystery. Can anybody help? That's 104.4 in the Manchester area. Energy FM 105.4. This station seems to be broadcasting during most of the weekend. Some technical problems at the moment, rather distorted audio, and a large amount of hum. They have Afro-Caribbean, religious programmes on Sunday morning, soul and reggae in the afternoons, a good programme variety. And they're in Moss Side. Frontline on 100.8. Broadcasts afternoons, evenings and weekends. Good quality audio, playing rave dance tracks. Frontline on 100.4 is another station with the same name, operating Saturday evenings, more mainstream dance music than the previous one, and on Sunday afternoons they have reggae. There's an unknown station on 100. Sunday afternoon this week, station played 80s pop and disco without any ID or record introduction. And also unknown on 101, a weak station complained on air about Frontline taking their frequency on 100. Well, thanks for that report from Nick Smith in Victoria Park in Manchester.
Some details of the proposed Channel 5 in Spectrum, the quarterly journal of the Independent Television Commission. You will search last year's Broadcasting Act in vain for a consolidated statement of the purposes of Channel 5 and the method by which it will be brought to life. The geographical coverage of the channel and the possibility that it might be provided under two or more licenses sharing the day or the week are dealt with in less than half a page of the Act. Rather more than a page is required to make it clear that the licensee appointed by the ITC will be required to retune equipment which is susceptible to interference. There is no mission statement, and no special provisions are made as they were for Channel 4 in the Broadcasting Act of 1980. There are merely a number of drab cross-references to other parts of the Act, which apply in equal measure to other ITC licensees. It seems at first sight implausible that an entirely new channel, as commentators have said, perhaps our last new terrestrial channel, which, if successful, will be a major factor in the broadcasting ecology of the United Kingdom, could be ushered in against so slight a background. But Channel 5 was envisaged from the White Paper of November 1988 onwards as coming within the standard framework for regulating commercial television under the Broadcasting Act. The government has closely followed its own prescription in setting for Channel 5 the same programme requirements: news and current affairs, religious and children's programmes, high-quality programmes and a diverse service, but not the regional programme obligations. And the same method of allocating the licence by competitive tender as apply to Channel 3. This is no cheap channel based entirely on repeats and imported programmes, nor a service devoted to a narrow range of interests among viewers. David Mellor acknowledged in Parliament during the passing of the legislation that it would not be easy to establish an entirely new terrestrial channel of this type in the hostile commercial environment of broadcasting in the 1990s. A number of commentators, most recently at the Royal Television Society convention at Cambridge, believe he will be proved right. Subject to certain specific minimum conditions, it therefore seems to be only sensible that the projectors of Channel 5 should be left with some freedom to find the appropriate place for the new channel, which will enable it to both bring something new to viewers and provide the basis for its own commercial success. The essential problem, from the regulator's point of view, has proved to be that many elements of the service likely to be of central interest to viewers, for example, the earliest possible start date for the service, the fastest possible development of coverage, and the best possible fulfilment of requirements in the Act related to programmes, are also items of considerable expense to the licensee. A single fledgling channel which is trying to build its audience and revenues against stiff competition will be susceptible to failure at an early stage if it tries to do too much too soon, and is, moreover, prevented from reacting with flexibility to the competition. On the one hand, a clear expectation of performance has to be established, against which the licensee must progressively develop his services. A standard set at the outset is also necessary in order that the ITC can form a view as to the capability of applicants to meet it, and so that the winning applicant can subsequently be required to achieve it. The general approach which the Commission has taken is therefore to provide the licensee with flexibility within the requirements of the Act. One aspect of this is the start date for the channel. The White Paper envisaged a start in early 1993, but it quickly emerged that this could not be achieved unless the job of building the transmission system for the new channel was set in hand immediately. The IBA advocated, unsuccessfully as it turned out, that the legislation which was then being prepared should allow building of the transmitters to start before the licensee was appointed. The ITC has tried to maintain the pressure for an early start and will now advertise the channel as early as possible in 1992, so that there is a good prospect of the service beginning early in 1994. We envisage the successful applicant being able to choose when he will start his service, provided that he does so by the end of 1994. The interest which has emerged in providing elements in local programming within the service has been accommodated by developing opt-out possibilities for major concentrations of population within the Channel 5 transmission plan. The number of areas which can now be separately served, subject to certain clearances being obtained, has grown from 25 in the original version of the plan to 33, while the total population coverage has increased from 70 to nearly 75%. The licensee would have to start his service with at least a given minimum of population coverage, although he could achieve this with no more than a handful of transmission sites operational. All sites would have to be operating to give the maximum possible coverage by perhaps the sixth year of the license term. The content of the service is the most significant instance in which we have acknowledged the benefit of gradual development within a clear framework. Requirements are set to which the program service must conform at the start, but scope is provided for progressive development of the service towards a higher minimum, which must be met by the sixth year, i.e. halfway through the term of the license. The licensee may also gradually expand the number of transmission hours, reaching a full service by the midpoint of the license term. The successful applicant may, of course, develop his service faster and further than the minimum which is set. In the end, it will be the successful applicant who holds the ITC's license who will give Channel 5 the character which it will need to make its way in the world. And that was by Michael Redley, who's head of licensing at the Independent Television Commission, and published, along with his article, is a map of the coverage that Channel 5 is predicted to provide. The most notable point, you probably know already, is that there is absolutely no coverage along the entire south coast of England, apart from one transmitter near the Isle of Wight. Irritatingly, it will not be at Roeridge, where existing aerials are pointing. It's going to be at Fawley in the Southampton estuary. And you will also need new aerials for all of these channels to receive them properly, because they're just outside the groups covered by existing aerials. If you want to start chopping up aluminium right now, here are the frequencies allocated. On channel 35, starting from the north, Mount Eagle, channel 35, all of these, Durris, Perth, Selkirk, in Northern Ireland, Black Mountain, Burnhope, Winterhill, Stourton, Belmont, and Oxford, Chelmsford, Huntshaw Cross, and Fawley. On channel 37, Londonderry, Black Hill, Taybridge, Emly Moor, Sutton Coalfield, Tackleston, Preseli, Mendip, Redruth, and Croydon. Interestingly, not Crystal Palace. Not a great deal of problem for people who are some distance away, but if you're close to the Crystal Palace mast, you'll have irritating problems of ghosting and getting satisfactory reception on both frequencies. And then on other frequencies, there are to be Craig Kelly, Caldbeck, Sheffield, Nottingham, Sandy Heath, from this map looking as though it's running considerably lower ERP than the other four services, and Church Downhill. So that's the 75% of national coverage for Channel 5.
Letter from David Andrew in Morecambe in Lancashire. He listens with an Eddie Stone EA12. I've enjoyed listening to Radio Facts recently, especially the sections about satellite and radio stations. He also listens on a Yaesu FRG7. He listens on both 6205 and on 3910 and reports the audio being excellent. He's got a long wire aerial. There's not much free radio activity in this area, although an FM station did appear briefly last year, but it's not been heard since. Thanks for that letter, David Andrew. And Jack Lydon writes from Rewla in Bangor. I receive you strongly on either 6205 or 3910, depending on the time of day. Now, the address of PDQ Publishing, he asks for. He didn't manage to get it all down because he wants to send for the Radio Listener's Guide. Well, the address for orders is Free Post, PDQ Publishing, P.O. Box 41, Didcot, Oxfordshire, OX11, 8BR. And please enclose £3.25. payable to PDQ Publishing. The address again, Radio Listener's Guide, Free Post, PDQ Publishing, PO Box 41, Didcot, Oxfordshire, OX11 8BR. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax, 3910 6205 and 12255. Fresh Radio Fax programmes start on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays.
You might remember a few weeks ago we did an item about the new digital systems being proposed for cinema sound. There's the Dolby system, which retains the analogue soundtrack and fits the digital data between the sprocket holes, and there was Kodak CDS, which recorded on digital only. You had to have separate film stock if you needed the analogue sound. In Television Buyer, Kodak CDS is killed off. Kodak has withdrawn major funding from the development of cinema digital sound, and its research partner, California-based Optical Radiation Corporation, has also slashed its investment and put its stake in CDS up for sale. When CDS was previewed in 1991 in London, broadcast experts praised its audio quality, which allows a six-track discrete digital audio mix to be heard in any converted cinema. But the system is a purely digital one, which is a problem for the analog film industry. For any transition to digital cinema audio, an analog compatibility is needed for at least the next 15 years. CDS met stiff resistance in America from film studios and cinemas who were reluctant to install expensive new technology, which was incompatible with existing analog techniques. Dolby's rival SRD, Cinema Analog and Digital Audio System, has already been demonstrated in Europe and is likely to start installation later this year. That was in Television Buyer. Thank you.
a letter from Pablo Gayo in Busto Garadolfo in Italia. He listens on an ICOM R70 on 3910. And also hello to someone writing in from Russia. He's usually able to receive radio fax on 3910. He's at Tolgeti City, and his name is Hotel Roman, and he sends a card dedicated to the October Revolution.